have been fabulous. And I know you will look forward and enjoy Scott L. from Nashville, Tennessee.
Thank you. Thank you. Good morning. My name is Scott, and I am an alcoholic. And honored and very, very moved and touched to be here. In the summer of 1984, the Southeastern was held in Atlanta, and I was in treatment in Atlanta. And as part of the agreement for me to get a weekend pass, I told them I'd go attend one of the speaker meetings, and I did. And it was where hope began for me, because I saw you having fun, and I didn't know that could be done at that point. I owe a debt of gratitude to this conference and what a gift it is for me to have a chance to maybe pour some back. So, MJ, I cannot tell you how moved I was and how grateful I am to be here. I'd like to thank the committee and everyone who was involved. I'd like to thank you for that wonderful basket of goodies in the room. I don't know what Red Riding Hood's grandmother's going to do because I ate them all. They're gone. But I have just had a magnificent time. I love the speakers. I've known, I guess, all but one for quite a while, and everybody just touched me so much. I just thank you. My home group is the Backroom Group in Nashville, Tennessee, and they send love, and they know how. And I think I'm going to talk about them a little bit today. And I like to think that's the end of my part of the program, because what I like to do is to open with a quotation from Lois Wilson, who was asked one time what she did in the moment of silence before the Serenity Prayer, and she said, "I invite God to the meeting." And, boy, that was powerful for me. And I started doing that, and meetings got better everywhere, okay? And I don't know how that happened. But what I'd like to do shortly is to have a moment of silence. And I'm going to ask everybody here, if you would please, to invite God to join us, to fill this room with love, and to bless us with open hearts, you that you might hear through yours. And hopefully, God, that he would speak through mine, or in the worst case, that I would speak through my heart. We talk in recovery about the language of the heart, and part of my journey has been learning to lay down the language of the gutter and pick up the language of the heart. I find them to be quite different. And I cannot report perfection, but very, very serious progress. And so anyway, just in case, because I noticed, I want to congratulate all of you here for the number of people under a year that were here for the countdown last night. Somebody's doing it right here, or it wouldn't have been that way. So congratulations on whoever it is that's getting these new people out to these things. But just in case there's someone here, you don't have a God, or you've got one you're afraid of, one you may be afraid to meet in a dark alley, or something that's just not working for you, or if you're just unsure, I want to encourage you to borrow mine for this time that we're together this morning. I'm serious as I can be. You can address him as the God of Scott's limited understanding. Might as well get off, tell him the truth. And just ask him to open your heart. And to fill this room with love, just do it for an experiment. Nobody seems to know if you do it. Just do it for a scientific experiment. We'll just see what happens. So let's all take a few moments now, if you would, please. And let's ask God to join us, to fill this room with love, and bless us all with open hearts. I'll just meet you back here. Let's have a moment. Amen. Thank you. That takes the heat off of me, doesn't it? I mean, this is a lousy talk. We all know whose fault it was. One of the things I've noticed, by the way, I found God is very difficult to train. Have you noticed that? Anyway, MJ asked me to tell my story, and I found the directions here in the big book. I know some of you are familiar with this book because I've been hearing you laugh. And I think laughter is the sound effect of recovery, isn't it? That was one of the big surprises for me. The people who really do this thing laugh a lot. But I found the directions here on page 29. It says, each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. So that must be what I'm supposed to talk about. I did not begin my life endeavoring to establish a relationship with God. I began life a victim of the delusion that I could wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if only I managed well. Recognize that? Page 61, yeah. I thought if I could get what I wanted, it would make me happy. I'm a poor observer. I don't want to tinker with our customs, but each time I introduce myself, I want to say, my name is Scott, and I have a learning disability known as alcoholism. I mean, I just wasn't getting it, were you? Just wasn't getting it. And But anyway, I thought if I could get what I wanted, it would make me happy. What I failed to notice was I was getting what I wanted most of the time, and that I wasn't happy. I started drinking in the summer I turned 18. I went away to college. I had not had a drink up until then, and I have a very good reason for that. I can explain. I have an excuse. I needed a drink way before then, but I didn't know what it would do. And I suspect my dad was one of us, because he told me when I was 11 or 12 years old, he said, there's beer in the refrigerator. Get one when you want it. And he meant that. That offer was good, and I knew it. And he said, one of these days you're going to want to get drunk for your very first time. And when that day comes, come to me. Tell me what you want to drink. I will buy it. And we will sit in the living room, and we will get drunk together for your first drunk. And that offer was good. He meant that, and I knew it. So as you can clearly see, it wasn't against the rules for me to drink. Therefore, I didn't drink. You followed that, didn't you? That made perfect sense to you, didn't it? Do not try to explain that to your neighbor. Anyway, I went away to college the summer I turned 18 and got out with the boys the first night, and they were drinking beer, and I wanted to be one of the boys, so I started drinking beer. And somewhere between the first sip of the first beer, and I think it happened by the time I got to the bottom of the second one, certainly no later than the bottom of the third. But the magic happened, and you alcoholics in the room know what I'm talking about. I just suddenly got taller. Did anybody else get taller? Because I see your hands. Where are you? Come on. Come on. Okay, a few tallers. How about better looking? Who got better looking? Yes. Yeah, my zits fell right off. Just boom, no pimple. I'm really surprised they don't use that on the TV ads. You know, Budweiser cures acne. I could just see that on the billboards. It worked for me because it was back the next morning. But, boy, I sure was pretty that night. And it lubricated my lips. I became a brilliant conversationalist. Did you have a little something to say? Huh? A little something to say? Yeah. How about this one? Expert on many subjects. Have a few experts. All right. Here you go. And you can't put up two hands if you need to. Fantastic dancer. Got a lot of doubles on that. Okay. But I tell you, the biggest thing that it did for me is it made me feel like I was as good as everybody else. Sometime when I was very, very small boy, I became convinced that I was defective, that there was something wrong with me that was irreparable, and that if you, defined as whoever's directly in front of me at any given time, if you ever found out who I really was, you wouldn't want me around. And nothing I ever did could ever possibly measure up. And I believe that at the same level that I believe that if I let go of this pad, it'll hit the table. It was just a truth. It wasn't something I thought. It was a truth, and I knew it for sure. And when I got out and started and got to the bottom like of that second beer, all of a sudden, we went from, I'm afraid y'all to find out who I am and not want me around, to, y'all is pretty lucky I was there. And that is an entire psyche change. And alcohol provided my first one. And to kind of skip through it, I zipped through a 4-year college and 5 years and 2 summer schools. Where are you? Okay. Yeah. The United States Air Force in the mid-1960s was using the mirror test. They, you know, put a little mirror under your nose. If you could fog that baby, they would take you. And they commissioned me a second lieutenant, sent me to Valdosta, Georgia, to Air Force pilot training. I'm going to talk to you just a little bit about what it was like to be a drunken pilot for the United States Air Force. Okay? For those of you who are flying home, it's not too late to change, catch the bus. Greyhound loves that I make this part of my talk, but in the second half of Air Force pilot training, we flew an airplane called the T-38 Talon. Did you see Top Gun? Everybody see the movie Top Gun? Okay. In the beginning of the movie and at the end of the movie, it had this dogfight with these MiGs. You didn't actually think that the Russian government loaned Hollywood MiGs so they could have a dogfight in the movie, did you? I'm sorry to have to tell you that they didn't. And that airplane that they said was a MiG is the airplane I'm talking about. I flew that thing for about 6 months. I'm going to tell you a little bit about what that airplane is like because it emphasizes what my alcoholism is like. The airplane would go from brake release on the runway to 40,000 feet in 3.5 minutes. We called it the White Rocket. The ones in the movie were black. The ones we flew were white. We called it the White Rocket. It was one. It has after-burning jet engines that will fly faster than the speed of sound. I've been through the Mach 15 or 20 times, I guess. I don't know. a loop in this airplane, which is a 360-degree turn through the vertical plane pulling positive Gs. That's a circle on the horizon. At 10,000 feet, you enter at 500 knots. It's about 550 miles an hour. And you pull up at 5 Gs. Now, you're pulling 1 G right now. That's the force of gravity. At 1 G, a 200-pound man weighs 200 pounds. At 5 Gs, a 200-pound man weighs 1,000 pounds. It means everything on you weighs times 5. All right, so we pull up at 5. If you've ridden a roller coaster when you hit the bottom of that first big hill and everything sags, that's about 2 Gs. All right, we pull 5 in a loop. Enter at 10,000 feet. Your wings level inverted at 20,000 feet. It takes 10,000 feet to pull this bird over on her back. And you lose 8,000 feet coming down the backside. The total lapse time on that entire maneuver is under 25 seconds. Okay? The roll rate on this airplane, if you use maximum deflection for your flight controls to one side or the other, she will roll in excess of 420 degrees a second. Yes, that's more than once around every second. I'll tell you a secret about that. Your eyeballs won't track that if you're sober. I flew up sober several times, and and they won't track that. So anyway, I would come down from a day of flying that airplane, and I would head over. They'd release us from the flight line around 5:30 in the afternoon. I'd head over to the officers' club. And now, I used to intentionally get drunk. I'm going out to get drunk tonight. The people say, "Well, why are you drunk?" I say, "Well, I'm celebrating. It's Arbor Day. I celebrate Arbor Day. Always do. Big deal for me." You don't know when Arbor Day is, do you? Well, they didn't either. So that was the one I always used. But so I used to intentionally get drunk frequently. But I also used to get drunk by mistake. Did anybody ever just sort of take drunk? Didn't really mean to? Where are you? Come on, where are you? I'm not going to do this by myself. All right. I come to talk with you, not to you. Okay? But I used to just get drunk by mistake. It's just kind of like a head cold. Just boom, all of a sudden there it was. I didn't mean to. Well, anyway. So I'd head over to the club about 5:30 in the afternoon, and I'm absolutely not going to get drunk tonight. That is not the plan. I'm just going to socialize with my classmates. Would y'all be willing to do audience participation with me? Let's try that again, class. Would you be willing to do audience participation? Yes. When I point at you, fill in the blanks. You know the answers. Are you ready? Okay. Walk into the club around 5:30. I'm planning not going to get drunk tonight. Absolutely not going to get drunk tonight. But I'm going to have one beer, no more than... Right. Now, hold, let me, are there Al-Anons here? Can I see your hands? Thank you for your support. I love you with all my heart. I think there's a lot of sober alcoholics who got sober because Al-Anon helped you get too healthy to continue to help one of us stay sick. So I really honor you, but I'm fixing to pull your leg a little. All right? You can play this game with us, too. You know the answers to these questions. This is what you heard on the phone. And you believed it again. That's why you have to go to Al-Anon. The ones that didn't believe it, that ran screaming, they don't have to come here. Okay. All right. So I'm going to have one beer, no more than... I should be home by 6:30, no later than... Sure. But what happens is somewhere between the first sip of the first beer and the bottom of the second one, I develop this phenomenon of craving that Dr. Silkworth discusses so eloquently in the Big Book. And I don't get home at 7. As a matter of fact, I leave the officers' club at exactly 1 o'clock in the morning because they... It's the biggest group of pilots I ever talked to, I guess. I drive home with a hand over one. Who knows why? Let's see the hands. All right. If anybody doesn't know why, talk to one of them later. It's really important. Now, my first wife, I get home just in time to listen to her hardest part of that. And then I would, I really hate to do this on Sunday morning, but I think it's important that I tell you the truth. Could I see the hands of the pukers, please? Come on. Where are you? Ah, these are my people. I don't know how the rest of you got here, but I thought the two most creative and important inventions of the 20th century were that little half-moon shape of carpet that they put around the commode for you to kneel on. That was invented by one of our boys, you know. And that soft commode seat you could rest your head on, you kind of in between heaves, you know. And I'm in there doing it. And if there's anybody here new, they're going to lie to you. I'm going back to Tennessee, and they're going to have to deal with you here. But they're going to lie to you. They're going to tell you you can't quit forever, and that is not true. I have personally quit forever over 2,000 times. Every time I puke. Who quit forever every time they puke? All right. Who quit forever? Solemn oath on the Bible more than once. Where are you? Yes, sir. These are my folks. I feel right at home here. And so I'm in there just bringing up my toenails, quitting forever. And then I would pray what I call, it's not in the literature as such. It is in one of the stories in the third edition, but it's not listed as the pre-AA prayer, but that's what I call it. We'll do it together. I'll do the first line. You do the second. Everybody ready? God, get me out of this.
Blech.
Yeah. We got all kinds of stuff in our literature, 40 questions, and do you need to be in AA and all. I got a one-question test for you if you're new and you're not sure you need to be here. Did you know the prayer? You might want to stick around. Brush my teeth and go to bed. It's now, what, 2:30 in the morning, 3 o'clock? I get up at 6 in that magical, wonderful place between drunk and hungover. Remember that one? I really miss that, don't you? Shower, and, you know, if Mr. Gillette had not invented the safety razor, somebody else would be speaking this morning. I would have killed myself with one of those straight ones. Shower and shave, flight and suit and boots, sunglasses and hat, hop in the car, drive about 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning. I'm in that airplane I was telling you about. I got about a Force 5 hangover now. And today we're in a two-ship formation. You been to the air show? Seen what they did? We do that. This airplane I'm telling you about, the Thunderbirds, the Air Force demonstration team flew it for 7 years. Right, this is no toy airplane. This is for real. And just after liftoff, I tucked under the leader's tail in what they call a closed trail. And if we're in closed trail and the leader's tail was right there, my instructor would be just screaming at me. That is nowhere near closed trail. I mean, when I say close, I mean really close. And we're pulling 5 G's doing that loop, going over the top with as bad a hangover as you've ever had. I'm dying. I got a butcher knife stuck in right here. It comes out the back. I was surprised my helmet went on over it. And my eyelids are made out of sandpaper. I got booze coming out of every pore. My throat is raw from puking all that acid the night before. And the only thing that keeps me going is the sure and certain knowledge that I'll never feel this way in the plane again because I quit last night forever and meant it with all my heart. And I'm hanging in there doing the deal. You know what I've just described to you? Do you know what that is? That's willpower. It is. It's no defense against this disease of ours, but that's willpower. I don't think the earth people should be allowed to say the word willpower. They got no idea what it means. They don't have the faintest notion of what it means. I sincerely believe it's why they don't become alcoholics, is they ain't got the willpower for it. The guy goes out on prom night. He drinks a fifth of Jack Daniels. He pukes on his day's dress. He wrecks his car. He winds up in the, wakes up in the drunk tank the next morning. He says, "I'm never doing that again," and he never does. Obvious lack of willpower. Couldn't hang. And so anyway, I'm dying in this airplane. And about five, by late in the afternoon, I'm recovering. I'm in my early 20s. My body's resilient. By 5:30, I'm not well, but I'm a lot better. And I know for sure I'm not going to get drunk tonight. But I think I may stop by the officers' club and socialize with my classmates for a little while. I think I'll stop and have one beer, no more than, should be home by 6:30, no later than, leave at exactly 1 in the morning because they drive home with a hand over one, listen to, "God, get me out of this."
Blech.
Over and over and over again. And I was unable to look into the past all the way to yesterday and say, "Gee, weren't you dying in this airplane yesterday morning about the same time of the same malady?" I couldn't see it. I was powerless over alcohol, and I was ignorant of the fact that I was powerless over alcohol. Tough combination, powerless and ignorant. Whew. Lived with it for a long time. I graduated from pilot training. As a matter of fact, I graduated high in my class. I had the gift. And I started flying C-141s out of Charleston, South Carolina, where the Ashley and Cooper Rivers flow together to form the Atlantic Ocean. I know about that. I couldn't help it. I'm sorry, but I love my time at Charleston, and we had a worldwide mission, and I was drunk on five continents and don't have a guess how many islands, and it was a mess. I got orders to Vietnam from there. I went over there in the old DC-3, and originally in the gunship, was eventually transferred to an intelligence mission that was classified above top secret, and taxiing my airplane out at 4 o'clock one morning. I tell you this, I was so drunk I couldn't have driven the crew bus from my quarters to the flight line. And I'm taxiing this airplane, and I taxied it off into the grass. I mean, I couldn't keep it on the pavement. Possibly some of you have had that experience with other types of vehicles. Thought so. Yeah. It was 4 in the morning, and if there'd been another plane taxiing behind mine, or if it had been 4 in the afternoon, or if I'd been closer to the tower so they could see what happened, I'd be serving the rest of my life in Leavenworth. And that's not an estimate. And I have the high honor and privilege of serving on the corrections committee out of my home group. My home group is taking about 45 meetings a month into jails and prisons in Metro Nashville. That's just my group. We are 60 men in June and July that are incarcerated got sponsors out of my home group. My group is funding about 3 cases of big books a month into the jails and prisons. And that doesn't count Salvation Army treatment centers and halfway houses. We do that too. I happen to be on the corrections committee. And I've never been arrested, but I'm just uncaught. The only differences between me and the guys on the inside are they got caught and I didn't. And I have this magnificent program of recovery and they don't. And I can't do anything about they got caught. But we're doing what we can about the rest of it. And it is such a gift to me. And someone asked my wife, Miss Linda sends love, by the way, but we've got twin grandsons, 4 months old, our first, and the rules have changed. If she ain't talking, she ain't coming. So she sends you love. But somebody asked her one time what she thought about the amount of time I spent in the prisons, and she said, I love it, because I love who he is when he comes out of there. And it doesn't have anything to do with I go home and they stay. That has nothing to do with it. It has to do with maybe I'm a tool in the master's hand. Maybe somebody's life gets changed because I come in there. And I had an experience a few years ago sitting in a little restaurant in Nashville. I'm just sitting there having lunch, and this fellow walks up to my table, and he says, you don't remember me. And I said, you know, if I should, I apologize, but I don't remember you. And he says, well, you came into a prison I was in a few years ago, and you spoke, and I heard what you said, and I believed you. And I'm doing what you said, and I'm never going to have to go back to jail. And I wanted to thank you for my freedom. I'm overpaid for the rest of my life for all of the times that I go because I was a tool in God's hand once in somebody's life. There's no higher calling for me. And by the way, if anybody's suffering who's taking meetings into jails and prisons? Can I see your hands? Okay. If anybody else in here is suffering from depression, get with one of these people and go into the jails and prisons. It'll knock that depression out faster than Prozac, and it does not require a prescription. And that's a fact. That's a fact. But it's just such a thrill for me to go do that. And the men that I sponsor are all active in that. That's what we do in our recovery family. But anyway, I taxied this old DC-3 out into the weeds. And if there had been stumps or a ditch or something, but there wasn't. And I turned her around and we took off. And people have asked me, how in the world could you fly drunk? Were you wondering that? How could you fly drunk? I can help you with that. It's a big sky. There isn't much up. Don't take my word for it. Next time you're outside, take a peek. It's huge, and there isn't much up there. Okay? So the secret to it is you keep it in the sky part. That's all there is to it. Well, everything you hit was on the ground, wasn't it? It's pretty obvious if you think about it. I walked away from the greatest job I've ever had because of this disease. At 5 years, I had to resign my commission. It was a question of time before I was going to wrap one around something, kill somebody or myself. And I walked away from it. I get back tonight. It was the best job I ever had. I got a job as a traveling salesman. If you're not serious about staying in recovery this time, before you get your next drink, I'd like to recommend you interview. Get yourself a job as a traveling salesman. bring you back to recovery faster than any other form of work that I know of. You need an overnight travel, expense account, boss living in another state. Those are the keys. And I was with a major corporation. I became an independent manufacturer's rep. And in the summer of 1984, my business partner put his wife in treatment. She had a Darvon addiction, prescription drugs. And he went through family week. And a few days after that, he and I played a new game that's sweeping the country called Intervention. Possibly some of y'all have played. And on June the 28th of 1984, which is my sobriety date, was also my belly button birthday. And I mention that because it still is. And that's the only thing I didn't have to change. I signed into a little treatment center outside of Atlanta. And they told me later I was one of the saddest looking people that ever came through the door. I was one of the saddest people that ever came through the door. Because when they told me I couldn't drink Miller Lite or martinis or scotch on the rocks or use some of the alcohol substitutes that I was using in pretty large quantities by that time, I never thought I was going to ever have any more fun. Did you? Huh? Never thought I was going to have any more fun. Enjoy a ball game or a weekend or a vacation or even laugh out loud. That's what I thought. I'd like to report that that has not been the case. I'm having more fun in my life. My laughter comes from a deeper place than it's ever come from before. See a bunch of people nod when I just said that? If you're new and don't know what I'm talking about, stick around till you do. Anyway, I'm in this treatment center pretty much against my will, and I knew I wasn't an alcoholic. I knew that when I got there. I also knew I wasn't addicted to marijuana because you can't be, but I also had to have it by 10 o'clock every morning. But I caught alcoholism in the treatment center. I did. From listening to you talk about how you drank. You know, if anybody attacked my drinking, I got shields for that. But my disease had no defense against your story. None. Anyway, I didn't sleep too much. Matter of fact, I didn't sleep at all the first three nights I was there. They say that's not uncommon for somebody on the mixture I was on. And I'm laying there this fourth night in this treatment center, and I know I'm not going to sleep again. And some of you probably know this, but at nighttime, if you're not sleeping and you're not drinking, it stays dark a long time. I mean, it goes on and on. Oh, just awful. And it's like lights out at 11, you got to stay in your room till 6:30 in the morning. That's not accurate, but you know the deal, something like that. So I'm laying there in this bed this night. And a review of my life happened to me. I did not do this. And it was not an instantaneous near-death experience kind of thing, but a review over several hours of my life. And I had always given myself credit for my intentions. I'm a very well-intended person. And my favorite intention was that I'm an amateur magician. I do cards and rope and that sort of thing. And I intended to get a clown suit. And when I was on the road, instead of running the saloons, put on the clown suit, go to the children's hospital, take my kid in and do a magic show for the kids. And I intended to do that for over 20 years. I thought I was one fabulous guy. You know, I give myself a double A plus with Oak Leaf Cluster for what a fabulous guy I was. Because one of these days, you know, I was going to do that because I was such a great guy. Our third step talks about a decision. For me, the difference between an intention and a decision is that an intention is followed by more intentions. A decision is followed by action. That's the difference. And this night, I'm laying in this treatment center, and the intentions are not there. I just can't see them. And all I can see is the actions. It's not near as pretty. And I got to the place where I started thinking about the worst thing I've ever done. Maybe you don't have one. I got a single one, stands alone. And I'd always been able to stop it. And a six-pack will knock that out. Three fast scotches will stop it. Man, I'm laying in this treatment center, and it won't go away. And I just lay there and thought about it and could not get it stopped. And I reached what I call bottom. I hear we use the term bottom a lot, but I haven't seen it defined in my literature. So I'm going to tell you what bottom meant to me. It didn't have anything to do with the physical plane. I had been in lots of kinds of trouble. I'd puked blood a couple of times. I'd been in plenty of trouble. Bottom wasn't physical. Bottom was in here. Bottom was when I hated my guts so bad and detested what I had done and what I had become at such a level that I would pay any price and do anything not to be that man anymore. That, for me, was bottom. It was of the spirit. And at that point, I assume it was my spirit, because what I'm going to describe to you happened in my chest. It did not happen in my throat, did not come out my mouth, and was not generated from my head. Something in here screamed, and I mean screamed, to a God that I don't think I believed in. Screamed out, God, forgive me. And I received this forgiveness in that moment. And I'll describe it to you as best I can. I'm laying on my back in this bed with my eyes shut. I can see the whole room. And if you've had x-rays taken of your teeth, they get you laying in that chair. When they finish, they pick up this lead apron that's laying on you, and it just, something heavy leaves you. That's what it was like. It was like something heavy was literally laying all over me and just flew up off of me. And I was so light, I thought I was going to come up off the bed. And I say again, with my eyes closed, I can see the whole room. I can see my roommate over there asleep. And there's this gorgeous, beautiful light that I'm laying in. And I think I took the first three steps in that moment. I know that I realized that there was a God. And that God, I know today, loves me beyond my capacity to receive love. When I got here, I was locked up like this. And what you all have taught me to do is to open to receive the gifts that have always been here. I don't think it's been God's unwillingness to give. It's been my inability to receive. That's where the problem has been. And I realized I lay in the presence of so much love, it almost hurt. And I knew this God had the power to forgive me and that I was forgiven. And I used to say he forgave me then. And I hope I don't offend anyone by this, but I don't speak for God, and I'm not comfortable around people that do, quite honestly. So I'm not sure if he forgave me then or if he had never judged me and I was just able to receive the forgiveness then. But I can speak for me and tell you that I did receive the forgiveness at that point. And I lay there in the Master's presence, and I'm not aware of anything else that passed between us, but I know that anytime I open the channel, and I'm the one responsible for that, I think, that something does pass between us, whether I'm aware of it or not, with what the Buddhists call my monkey mind. But I lay there in the Master's presence, and I couldn't tell you if it was a couple of seconds or a couple of hours after that. I don't know. And after that, I slept some. And I awakened the next morning wanting to be one of his guys. And that was my first cornerstone. And Bill talks about that on page 12 in his story. It says, but soon the sense of his presence had been blotted out by worldly clamors, mostly those within myself. I'd like to tell you that I believe with all my heart I would not be sober today if I'd tried to hang on that single experience. It was necessary for me to have the educational variety described on page 569 and 570 in the back of the book. That would have been insufficient. That was merely a cornerstone for me. It was a fantastic one, and I love to speak because I get a chance to remember that. I remember it clearer when I'm talking to you than any other time. But I lay there in the Master's presence for a while, and I awaken the next morning wanting recovery. My second cornerstone happened a couple of weeks later. I went into my counselor's office. He was working on my aftercare plan. I knew that. And I went in there to assist him. If you don't know why that's funny, listen real close now, okay? This is important. It was an 11 o'clock meeting. I know that because I left there and went to lunch. It was a weekday. And I walked through the door, and I explained to him to try to lay out the parameters so he could do his job, just trying to assist the man, that I was not going to take an abuse, that I was not going to go to a halfway house, and that they had a 28-day program, and I wasn't staying a minute longer. And he said, well, you've left out something you aren't going to do. I said, what? He said, you aren't going to make it. I'd like to salute you again. He's a member of Al-Anon. I owe you a debt I can't repay. I'm serious as I can be. Serious as I can be. And he stunned me when he said that. And in language I like to think I don't use too much anymore, I asked him generally, why'd you say that to me? And he asked me this fantastic question. He said, if you already know how to run a program to keep yourself clean and sober, how is it you happen to be a patient here? And I responded, huh? And nothing came out, and that had never happened to me before. Did you have an answer? Did you always have an answer? I always had an answer. I couldn't answer the question. I don't know how long I stayed in his office. I don't know if I left then or if we stayed for a whole hour. I have no idea. But I couldn't get the question out of my mind. I left there, I went to lunch, and through lunch, all I could think about was the unanswerable question. And that afternoon, my body went where it was supposed to be, you know, to the movie and coping skills and group visit, whatever they had. My body was where it was supposed to be. My mind is back in this man's office trying to answer the unanswerable question. And at dusk, around 9 o'clock that night, I could show you within a couple of feet of where I was walking when the answer came here, like that. And the answer was and is, I don't know how to run a program to keep myself sober. And if I'm going to be one of the very few that make it, I'm going to have to do it all. This is not smorgasbord for me. I don't get to take what I want and leave the rest. My wager is too high. I've got too much on the table. I'm going to tell you about my wager right now. This is my wager. This is my recovery. And everything in my life that means anything to me is suspended from it. My freedom. I told you I'm supposed to be serving life in Leavenworth. My sanity. I have awakened in the rubber room in an insane asylum and withdrawal. My life. I could have been killed any number of times. I don't think I could impress anybody in here. My relationship with the most fabulous woman I've ever known in my life, Miss Linda. Some of you know her. My relationship with my children, with now our grandchildren. My peace of mind. My house. My cars. Anything in my life that means anything to me is suspended from my recovery. Because if I lose it, everything else hits the floor and shatters. I don't know where you are. That's where I am. That is a large wager. It's the largest bet I've ever placed. And what I'm betting is what's in this book will work for me. I do not get to take what I want and leave the rest. My wager is too high. And at that point, I surrendered to what I lovingly call Step 1, Section B. I was confused. I thought the word therefore appeared in the first step. I thought it said, we admitted we're powerless over alcohol, therefore our lives have become unmanageable. On close examination, I find that that's a hyphen or a dash. And I looked that up in my dictionary. It connects two thoughts. The reason I was confused is that on June the 27th of 1984, the fact that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life was unmanageable, the fact that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life was a disaster were related. Today, the fact that I am powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable are not related. And I'm not playing games with you. This is one of the most important concepts that's ever been driven home for me. See, I managed my own life for 41 years. I fired me. In my own enlightened self-interest, I have fired me. I don't want to manage my life again. I know what happens when I manage my life. I need a God to manage my life, which is at least in part for me what the 12 steps were about. My God has a first sergeant. We call him Ice Cream Steve in Nashville. And if you ever get a chance to talk to the ice cream man, brace yourself. He is an animal. And to me, he's God's first sergeant. And I'm surrendered to my sponsor. I spoke in a meeting in Mississippi, as a matter of fact, about 5 years ago. And mentioned on the he and I both had a former sponsor named Don Roy that some of y'all probably knew. And when I asked the ice cream man to sponsor me, I said, lay out my marching orders. And he said, okay, I want you to read a couple of pages in the big book every day. I want you to open and close your day on 86 and 87. I want you active in the prison systems. I mean, he had some marching orders for me. And I said, that's great. And I spoke at this little meeting in Mississippi, and I mentioned that one of the things that he had me doing was the exact opposite of what Don had me doing. I don't mean a little bit. 180 degrees, boom, exact opposite. And I mentioned that. Ice Cream Steve heard the tape. And he said, I heard on that Mississippi tape that I got you doing something that was the exact opposite of what Don Roy had you doing. And I said, that's right. He didn't ask me what it was, and I didn't tell him, and I ain't telling you. Because that's not the point. The point is that I'm surrendered to my sponsor. I'm doing what the man's asking me to do, and it's working for me. Because when my disease is alive and well up here in my head. And when I just fully surrender to him, I take my disease out of the decision-making process as it applies to my recovery. Does that make sense? It's working for me. And the ice cream man does not allow me to sponsor men that don't do what I ask them to do. Now, I don't want to run their lives. Step 1, Section B says my life's unmanageable. If I can't manage mine, I darn sure can't manage his. But I can manage his recovery program. I mean, I don't know if he needs to buy a dog, get divorced, move to San Diego. How would I know? How would I know? But I know that if he will do these 12 steps out of this book and stay active in our fellowship, he'll get long-term recovery. I know that. And so that's what I insist that they do. And if someone will prove to me that they won't do what I ask them to do, I must fire them. And I hate it. I hate it. And I've had to do it 4 times this year. And I absolutely hate it. I want to read a couple of things because I think they're so important. This is page 95 in the text. If he is not interested in your solution, my solution is the 12 steps. If he expects you to act only as a banker for his financial difficulties or a nurse for his sprees, you may have to drop him until he changes his mind. Page 96. We find it a waste of time to keep chasing a man who cannot or will not work with you. And the reason, what I tell them when I fire them, I say, I love you. And I want this to work for you, but I don't think your way is going to work. And if you won't do these 12 steps, I don't think you can get recovery. and it's my responsibility to make sure you know that you didn't try AA. And the reason is because if I don't do that, I have bet his life. Because if I think he's going to drink again, I'm probably right. I may not be, but I probably am. And the next time he wakes up in the drunk tank in a pool of his own blood and vomit, I want him to have three options open. And they are to continue to live that way, to take his own life, or to try Alcoholics Anonymous knowing he hasn't tried it. If I don't tell him he hasn't done AA, I have signed his death warrant. And I hate it. I hate it with a passion. But I must do it because I cannot afford the price of wagering his life. And if he won't do these 12 steps, I can't help him. And I got to make sure that he knows that. And say, I'm sorry, but that's my perspective. Let me tell you, too, I'm no expert. And if anybody disagrees with something I say up here, I look forward to hearing what you have to say, not to sell you my idea, but you may teach me something. Because one of the things I know for sure is that some of what I know for sure ain't so. I can show you four or five places in the book that says that. So I'm looking for those kinds of things. So anyway, I get this idea at this treatment center that I'm not going to manage my own program of recovery at this point. And so I surrendered to the staff at that hospital. And whatever they said, I just did. And I zipped through their 28-day treatment program in 6 weeks flat. And I've always been quick study, you know. And went back to Nashville, and the only guy in the city of Nashville that I knew that was in recovery owned one of the businesses that I called on. And I didn't want him to know. You understand that, don't you? Newcomer thinking, there's really nothing quite like it. I set out to follow this aftercare plan, 90 meetings in 90 days. It said, stay away from your old playmates and playgrounds. I did not allow my car to make the turn onto 8th Avenue South in Nashville, which is where my home bar was, until I had a 2-year chip in my pocket. I'm not kidding. I had a 2-year chip the first time my car was on that street. I was that serious about it. I didn't call the old drinking buddies. They said to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I tried. I got to 87. There were 3 days that were just physically not possible with family emergencies and whatnot, and I didn't know you could go to 2 meetings in a day. Newcomer thinking, right? I completed the 4-step treatment center guide. There was one of those psychobabbles, do you still hate your mother? Kind of. I'd like to recommend the actual 4-step. The real live, sure enough, 4-step. Yeah. One of a kind. For those of you who don't know, it's a series of lists, observations, and prayers. And in my experience, it has been the observations and prayers that have made the changes in my life and the lives of the men I've sponsored. If you don't know what I'm talking about, please, if you have your life bet on this too, get with somebody that just went like this real violently. They know. There's about 26 directions in here on how to take a 4-step. It takes me 2 hours to do a workshop on them. But anyway, I completed this, you know, do you look in the toilet before you flush, fill in the blanks, 4-step. And I called back down to the treatment center to get, if you haven't done the steps, I mean, they looked to me like the steps were designed to punish me. Yeah, when you first saw them, didn't they look that way? They looked to me like they were written by a hanging judge who was having a very bad day. And I was wrong about that. The steps were designed to enable me to lay down my burden. And I didn't know that. It was just one of the things I was wrong about. There were so many. But I called back down to the treatment center to a counselor named Bernie. Now, he hadn't been my counselor, but I had asked him if he would hear my 5th step before I left the treatment center. The reason I selected him is because you could look at him and tell he was ripped out of his mind. You know what it looks like. He got kind of his little soft grin on his face all the time, and he moves slow, and he talks slow. You know what it looks like when somebody's stoned. And I thought, I'm going to, because I know I've had my big spiritual experience, I know I'm actually going to have to do a real 5th step. I'm going to have to tell him all that. If I tell this junkie, 5 days later, he won't know whether I did it, much less what I said. So I thought he's a great choice. So he agreed. I called him. We booked it. I drove down to Atlanta, took my 5th step with Bernie, which is where I began to get relief. I should have gotten relief much earlier in the steps, but I was doing them out of a treatment center guide instead of the actual guide. Okay? And anyway, I finished my 5th step with Bernie and I headed home. Just as a point of order under the count of for whatever it's worth category, Bernie was not stoned. He was sober over 20 years. That was serenity. I didn't know what it looked like. Newcomer thinking, huh? You betcha. So I'm back in Nashville, and the only thing I haven't done on this aftercare list is get a sponsor. Now, newcomer thinking, all right, I was crazy, I was so insane that I was looking for a sponsor I could, can you fill it in? Relate to. Isn't that hilarious? Can you think of anything more stupid? I can't. I know it's Fanny from Straight Up. That's who I can relate to. I didn't need a sponsor I could relate to, and I don't today. I needed a winner for a sponsor. I needed a sponsor I would obey. Ooh, concept I didn't have. Anyway, there was this this fella in this meeting I was in, and his lights were on. You know what I'm talking about. He was all lit up. And I went up to him, and I said, would you sponsor me? And he said, here's an assignment. Do this, and I'll sponsor you. And I'd love to tell you the story, but it takes too much time. If somebody wants to know later, I'll be glad to tell you. I'm not ashamed of this assignment. He sponsored me by assignment. I hope you're sponsored by assignment. I hope you're sponsoring by assignment. But anyway, he gave me this assignment. It was a tough one. I came back to him a week later. I said, Jerry, I did the assignment. He said, good, I'll sponsor you my way. I said, fine, what's that? He said, you are too sick to stay sober on the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. You will need the program also. And I don't know what he's talking about. His name is Jerry Crow, and he's chairing the big meeting now. And he touched a lot of lives. And he said to the he outlived what the doctor said by 10 years. And I see that in this fellowship a lot. You know, that sunlight of the Spirit, we're still here as long as we got mission left. I don't care what the doctor says. And he said to the end, he thought the very best kept secret in our fellowship was the definition of our program. The way we keep it secret, of course, is we read it at every meeting. The sentence before the first step. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. No steps, no program. I hate to offend anybody. It's a simple truth. There's the definition. No steps, no program. Don't drink and go to meetings. It's not our program of recovery. Yeah. If sitting around with a bunch of other alcoholics talking about our problems was going to get people sober, wouldn't the guys under the bridge be sober? Wouldn't a lot of the guys and gals on the bar stools be sober? That ain't it. That ain't it. That's actually illuminated on page Roman numeral 22 in the forward to the third edition, where it says the 12 steps that summarize the program. So that means that the ones I see with the numbers in front of them on page 59 and 60 are a summary. That's the cliff notes. I'm afraid to try to just get a C in Alcoholics Anonymous. My wager's too high. I need to shoot for an A because I can't afford to flunk here. So I can't try to slide by on the short form. And I got a good friend that says if you take the steps off the wall, you get off the wall program. So when I'm talking about the program, I'm talking about the full shot. Anyway, Jerry says you must do, take, work the 12 steps. It wasn't learn, wasn't understand. It was an action verb. Doesn't matter to me. It doesn't matter which one. And I was rigorously honest with the man. I said, Jerry, I don't want to. Because I'd looked ahead. That ninth step didn't look that enticing to me. And I said, Jerry, I don't want to take the 12 steps. And he said, that's okay. I said, good. He said, as long as you take them. Jerry, we're graduates of the same university, son. I don't believe we're communicating. He said, yeah, we are. Sure we are. That's the definition of willingness. Willingness is when I do what my sponsor says, whether I like it or not. Oh, I can do things I don't want to do? New concept. Didn't have that one. And I allowed the man to coach me through the 12 steps. Changed my life. I needed to be changed, but I didn't have the power to change me. But I surrendered to someone who had been changed and allowed him to show me how he had been changed. And he told me if I would do the things that he had done, I'd get the things he had. And I wanted to feel like he looked. And I knew it was real. And today I'm absolutely certain it was real. And so I allowed him to coach me through these 12 steps, and he changed me. And I believe saved my life. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit. I want to tell you the story I'm about to tell has a happy ending. Okay, this daughter I'm going to tell you about is doing great. But July the 4th, 7 years ago, she put a pistol in her mouth and fired it. And I found her about 6 hours later. 45 minutes later, in the front room of Vanderbilt Hospital, there was about 30 of you having a prayer meeting. By dark, it looked just like this. They told us for the first 4 days that she would not live, and I didn't say may. They said, you all need to plan your funeral for just a little bit later on this week. She's still alive right now, but we can't save her. I'm going to tell you something. 4 days is a very long time to sit at your baby's bed holding her hand. Now, she can't talk. They got these tubes stuck in her, and she's a nightmare to look at. But she can squeeze you once for yes and twice for no. 4 days is a long time to sit there. And I believe if I hadn't allowed that man to coach me through this work, I don't think I could have done it. I do not think I could have done it. You people were astonishing. I don't know how long the prayer meeting went on. I can tell you I lived in that hospital for the next 60 days. And you put a 24-hour watch on me. 24 hours a day, there was a member of my home group no further away from me than this gentleman right here in the front row. They camped out in the hall so that at 4 o'clock in the morning, if I needed to cry, one of my people would be there to hold me. They didn't do it to keep me from drinking. They never even thought of that. You're not stopping me from drinking. They did that because they loved me. Love was action for them. I know who you are. I saw what you did. I learned from Al-Anon, I don't trust the words anymore. I trust the actions. I'm a word merchant myself, right? I'm not too strong on the words, but I saw the actions. I know who you are because I saw what you did. And I'm so proud to be a member of your fellowship. I can't tell you. Cannot tell you. I owe a debt I can never even think about repaying. It's part of why I'm here. It seems like every time I try to repay some, I get more. I worked hard, by the way, for these tears. I got here unable to cry. I was suffering from what I call the John Wayne complex. Let me give it to you. Big boys don't cry. Never apologize. It's a sign of weakness. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Never let them see your weakness. Never ask a stupid question. Never surrender. Never give up, no matter what. At about age 11, they convinced me that's what a man was, and I pretended to be that for 30 years. And I was an act all the time, and it was BS. It all was. And I was a fake. Today, I'm real. And a guy in my home group was crying at almost every meeting, a very masculine guy. And I looked at him and said, Tony, talk to me about the tears. And he said, well, something beautiful touches my heart in this meeting, and I just weep. And I said, I can't cry, Tony. And he said, I'll coach you. Tony coached me for a year, and I can cry. And I'm so proud of that. I've worked very hard for it. And if you have disrespect for me because I can cry, or because I do cry, I'm okay with that. I'm okay with it. A guy named Cherry Carpenter is one of the deans of Nashville AA when I got sober, and he said, I'd rather be despised for who I am than loved for who I'm not. And I couldn't say that when I got here, but I can now. And I hope you like me. I really do. And I'm okay if you don't. Huh? What a fantastic gift. My daughter lived. Her boyfriend called me about 6 months ago, and they honored me by his asking me for her hand in marriage. And he's a beauty. Oh, we'll take him. He'll do great because we have perspective. Oh, he is just a wonderful guy. And she's doing great. She's blind in one eye. She's lost a little coordination, but she's fine. She's doing fine. I found myself kneeling by my daughter's bed, saying to my God, if it's your will to take her, take her. If it's your will to leave her here badly damaged, leave her here that way. And if it's your will to leave her here okay, leave her here okay. I was called on to hold the most precious thing in my life up to this God. And he's worthy of that. And I didn't know that until I had to do it. I sponsor a man whose son did not live. And he's doing great. He didn't drink again. I gave him his 15-year chip in December. And his son didn't live. And emotionally, he was gone a long time. I was out for a while emotionally. I say again, he did not go back out. But emotionally, he was gone a year. He's back now. He's doing fantastic. And he said it better than I could. And what he said was, one of these days, you're going to have to go to the mountain all by yourself. If you haven't done the 12 steps out of this book and you don't know how to reach up and take the master's hand, you're not going to be able to go. And I believe that because I had to go. And I believe we all will have to go. Anyway, when Jerry was telling me I had to work these 12 steps, I asked him why. And he said, well, think of yourself as a garbage can. Not too difficult. What we will do with these steps is dump you out. We'll scrub the can and stand it back upright. We'll fish through your life. Most of it's garbage, and we will throw it away. But some portions are good, and we will keep them. Two examples. He said, do you love your children? I said, very much. He said, great, we'll keep that. And then he got smart with me. He loved that. He said, when you go to work, you do a good job, don't you? I said, yeah, well, keep some of that. And when we get through with these 12 steps, you're going to be a great big can clean with only about this much good stuff in the bottom. Our program's kind of like going to the dentist. We got to drill before we can fill. Okay? We got to dig this poison out of you. That's what some of the step work's about. I think that may be what 4, 5, 8, 9, and 10 are about. It's about digging this poison out. Because if we just fill on top of it, it's going to get sick in there. Eventually, it's going to explode. And he says, you're going to need that big, clean can because alcohol ain't your problem. I said, now, wait a minute. He said, alcohol is not your problem. He was right. I had my first drink, first effective drink in the summer of 61. My current one on June the 27th of 84. Neither of those two drinks nor anyone in between was alcohol ever my problem. Not one time. It was my answer. Right? Made me tall enough, good looking enough, made me feel like I belonged, did all that stuff for me. So when they said to me, lay down booze, they weren't saying put down your problem. They're saying now put down the only answer you've ever known. The only thing that ever made your skin fit. The only thing that ever made it okay for you, just be you. The only thing that ever made your life work. Put that down. Wow. I don't know where you are. That's where I was. That's where I am now. So if alcohol is not my problem, if alcohol is my problem, then not drinking alcohol is my answer. And that never worked. So when I lay down the booze, I need to be changed, and I can't change me. And it was in doing these 12 steps that I was changed. And he said I was going to need that big empty can to store pain in one of these days. And he was right. And he said, you'll store the pain in that empty can while we love you back to spiritual health. And if you don't dig the poison out of there first, you won't have anywhere to store it. I usually tell that before the story about my daughter, but I had caffeine. I probably shouldn't take drugs at all. Lighten up a little bit. There were slogans on the wall when I got to the old Woodbine Club in Nashville, and one of them said, let go and let God. I thought that must be a really good idea. I wonder how they do that. And another one said, first things first, and I understood that, but I was a newcomer. Of course, I wasn't doing it. And one of them said, one day at a time. I knew what that meant. That meant don't drink today. And if you're new, it means that. But it also eventually meant that if I use the first 10 steps and clean up my past, there's nothing gaining on me. As I continue to develop a relationship with a loving God who wants what's best for me and he knows what it is and I don't, I get excited about the idea that my future's in his hands. Past is clean. A loving God holds the future. For me, it requires both of those things to free me to live one day at a time in this day. If I don't have both of those in place, I can't be here. That's why I had to do the steps, is so I could be here. Because I can't be here if I don't do both of those things. Anyway, they had another slogan on the wall that just made me nuts. Which one was it? Think, 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 think. Oh, Jesus. A friend of mine in Nashville refers to his head as his home entertainment center. Has everything it needs but off switch. I can't find that in my literature. I cannot find think, think, think in my literature. So I took it upon myself to decide what it means. Take what you can use and leave the rest. This is what it means to me. That means three thinks is the limit. Okay? Whatever it is, I can think about it once. That's okay. I can think about it twice. I can think about it the third time. When I think about it the third time, I must lay it down. If I were going to outthink it, I would have outthunk it in three thinks. If I go to the fourth think, I got a problem with step one, section B, I'm trying to manage it. I quit praying for God's guidance when I was sober 2 years. This morning I prayed that I might be open to his guidance. I think a loving God sends that guidance every day as a free and clear gift. So I changed it. And I think I only get a certain amount of spiritual energy on any given day. And if I squander it, sweating the past, or worrying about the future, you know what worry is? It's a form of prayer. Worry is how I tell God Almighty I'm absolutely certain that he cannot handle the future. I'm not sure that's a good prayer. I try to leave it alone. But if I squander my spiritual energy in the future, in the past, I won't have enough for today. I moved out of the home my first wife and I were living in when I was sober 6 years. And the reason I moved out is she was about 5'3 and about 105, and I'm 6 feet and 210, and I was about to give her a straight right and follow up. And I was going to jail and she was going to the hospital, and that wasn't going to be the best thing. And I moved out because of that. And I didn't know what to do. I'm not terribly religious, but my religious belief said I'm not supposed to get divorced. My mind, clear, 6 years sober, says, live with her, you're going to pound her into the pavement. And I didn't know what to do. So I prayed three prayers each morning. I share them with you in case you may need them. The first one, I said, God, if it's your will for us to be together, put us together. Second one, if it's your will for us to be apart, put us apart. Here's the one that counts, folks. If it's your will for me not to know today, leave me not knowing. That's the one. Step one, section B. That's the one that takes me out of management. One day at a time, the most difficult concept I've ever run across. And I asked him that every day. If it was his will for me not to know today, leave me not knowing. And I was free to be there. Because if I'm trying to extract guidance that isn't coming for 3 years, every day in between, look at all the days I'm going to miss. Guidance will be here on time. The question is, am I open to it? And just because I think it's a big deal coming in the future doesn't mean that today's guidance is... Today must be really important. Look how many of God's kids he gave today to. I need to be here. No matter what's coming, my assignment is still in this day. Hard concept, but that prayer meant a lot to me. I walked out of a meeting a few years ago, and there was a fellow whose sponsor I sponsored came up to me, and he said, I disagree with what you said in the meeting today. And I'd say again, please disagree. If you got something, I might learn, and I would be most grateful for that. What I had said was that my amends to my children would never be complete. And Nick said, did you go to them and tell them what you felt you'd done wrong? Did you ask them how to repair the damage? Did you do what they said? Did you ask for their forgiveness, and did they give it? I said, yes to all of that. He said, you're trying to be the best dad you can be today isn't ninth-step work. It's 12. That's the principles in all your affairs. And if you think it's ninth-step work, you have not accepted their forgiveness or God's or your own, and you have work to do. If you're doing this, it's okay with me. My book doesn't say anything about living amends. It's not in here. I don't have to live in the guilt today. I'm trying to be the best dad I can be today. It's not ninth-step work. It's not because I was bad in the past. It's because I'm practicing the principles of my affairs today. And that allowed me to step away from some guilt. I hope it touches somebody else. That's why I share it. I'm going to talk to you about the worst thing I ever did. I hope I don't offend anyone. If you've done what I'm about to describe and you're okay with it, I'm okay with it. That's not what this is about. This is about how I got free. As a young man, I paid for an abortion, and it festered my soul, and I drank over it. I did anything I had to do to get that out of my mind and where that would have gone. And that's what I was thinking about that night in that treatment center when my soul screamed out for forgiveness. And I received the forgiveness, but when I got to the ninth step, it seemed to me that I owed amends to an unborn child, and I didn't think that could be done. I have been blessed from my early days to be in the hands of sponsors who knew what was in this book. I want to read to you from page 83. Some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter. I was asked the question, can that child be seen? I said, no. We're going to sit down outside, and you're going to write that child a letter. We're going to do it outside under God's sky, not indoors under man's roof. I had learned to cry by then. If you have one of these to write and you haven't learned to cry, please see me and let me coach you. And I can send it to you on email. I can write to you. It's about 10 pages. I can help you learn to cry. Because as the fourth step was not about writing, it was the observations and prayers that made the changes. For me, this letter work was not about writing. It was about tears. And I was told to, we're sitting outside and I'm starting to write, dear unborn, and I start bawling. My instructions are to cry as long as I possibly can. Lay the pen down. Do not write and cry at the same time because you compress the time frame and it won't be complete. Lay it down. Cry as long as you can and then begin to write again. Dear unborn child, crying again. Lay it down. Went through that process. And it's a letter. And it's all about love and how sorry I am and asking forgiveness. And when I thought I was finished. I got to the end. I was told to sign it, love, Dad. I was not through crying. I promise you, I was not through crying. And I got free. And I was handed a plain white envelope and told to address it. And I said, how? Where is that child? I said, with God. I said, right, in heaven. And God and that child are not mad. There's no resentment there. There's no hate. There's no anger. They're pulling for you to get free. I addressed the envelope. And I addressed an envelope to an unborn child in heaven. And I was told to put extra postage on it. That's a long way from Nashville, Tennessee. And I got free. And I had the privilege a couple of years ago. A guy drove a long way. My mama died 2.5 years ago. And I wear the tie in her honor, by the way. She had a near-death experience. And she said the reason they can't find the Garden of Eden here is because it ain't here. It's over there. She'd seen it. And I wear the garden tie in Mary Jo's honor. I dreamed about her last night. It was so good to see her. But anyway, this fella drove a long way to be at her. We called it a going away party. The preacher called it a memorial service. It's a perspective thing, I suppose. I have just started 3 years ago telling this abortion story from the podium. And my book doesn't tell me anything about how to hear a fist step. It tells me how to give one. I'm supposed to illuminate. But it didn't tell me how to hear one. So all I had was what my lineage passed to me. And my lineage, we don't hear fist steps. We exchange. And so, consequently, a guy that I sponsored who had not been involved in abortion knew about mine. And when he came up with a guy that he was sponsoring that had one, actually two, He got that man's permission and called me. And the three of us sat while this guy, because he didn't have the experience. Isn't that wonderful? And we sat together while this guy wrote his letter and cried. And when we were finished and I handed him this envelope, which that's, by the way, the alternate, the other person's job is to pray while you're writing. I handed him a plain white envelope and he said, "I want to burn this." The book didn't say we mailed it, said we sent it. And where they are, I think I can send it better as smoke. I didn't come to argue with that. And we went over by the roses and he held a kitchen match to that until it was ash and crumbled it and put it on the roses and he got free. And I don't have his permission to tell you that. He begged me to tell you because he got free. And I've had the privilege of sitting with an awful lot of people who have needed to do this work. And if you need to do this work, I'd love to talk to you later. But I share that only in the hopes that maybe somebody else will get free. But, you know, I don't learn from my mistakes. They were wrong about that. Never did. You know what I learned from? Living with the results of my mistakes. That's why steps 4, 5, 8, 9, and 10 are so critical to me. Because I don't learn. I'm like the poodle that wets on the rug. I mean, what did he learn? Nothing. When did he start learning? When you rubbed his nose in it. Right? I'm just like the poodle. And what I do with those steps is I embrace the results of my mistakes so that I learn not to make them again. And I don't think I'm perfect. I don't think I am. I'm still making mistakes. But trying to live what's in this book, today I make a much finer quality of mistake than I ever made before. I think that's important. Matter of fact, I think it's my job. In my own particular religious belief, the job of being perfect is already taken. There's not even an address where you can mail a resume. I mean, that's not my job. Well, if it's not my job to be perfect, it must be my job to make mistakes. And I'm good at it. And what I'm supposed to do is learn from them, to get his help, repair the damage, and go on to make a finer quality mistake. And I swear that's what my recovery's been about. We have a name for that. We call it progress. That's all it is to me. All of my problems today fall under what I lovingly call Step 1, Section B. If I'm upset about it, I'm trying to manage it. No matter what, from the way you drive your car, to international politics, to the fact that my magnificent wife puts the toilet paper on the roll backwards. It should feed over the top, as you know. Yeah. Yeah. Wait, let me tell you what her excuse is. You know what she says? She puts it on the other way. She says, because we have a cat. Let me tell you something. Been watching that cat for 7 years. He don't use it. When I was new to recovery, I was saying insane things like, I'm having a good day or I'm having a bad day. Isn't that crazy? Isn't that absolutely crazy? What am I saying? When I'm saying I'm having a good day, I'm saying my will is being done today. And when I say I'm having a bad day, what am I saying? My will isn't being done today. Either my will is one of the biggest problems I got, or there's a lot of mistakes in this book. It's one or the other. When I was living in a little house by myself, I took a picture out of my wallet of me taken when I was about 4 years old. And if you ask me later, I'll be glad to show it to you. Cute little boy. And I had it blown up a couple of feet wide and 3 feet high and put it on the wall at the foot of the bed. And I didn't know why, but it didn't violate any principles that I knew of, so I went ahead and did it. Sometime about the time that picture was taken, I started being abused, and I was abused for a lot of years after that. And I'm not here to talk about that, and nothing happened in here when I just said that. Because I've been through the forgiveness process in the fourth step. I hope you know what I'm talking about. I hope you find out if you don't. But I tell that story because I'm laying there in bed looking at that beautiful little boy. And I wondered one time, who would he have become? If he'd received all the love and nurturing guidance that he clearly deserved as a child of God, who would he become? And I got an answer. And the answer is, that's my job. It's my job to become the man that beautiful little boy would have become. I'm not saying the abuse didn't happen. I'm not saying I didn't do some horrible things. I serve a powerful God, gave me a powerful program, more powerful than all of that. The question is, do I accept the assignment of becoming the beautiful man that little boy would have become? The only directions I've ever found that led me in that direction are in this book. That's a little bit about what the step work has been about for me. Today, I belong. I told you that the biggest thing booze did for me is it made me feel like I belong. Today, I belong. I'm one of you curveballs, you know? I'm way out of the strike zone. I belong here. I belong here. And I will feel that way tomorrow morning. I belong here. I've never had anything like it. A friend of mine says he loves sitting in AA meetings because for an hour a day, he's in a room full of people whose brains misfire on the same rhythm as his. And I think that's right, too. We, at my home group, by the way, we stopped giving our phone numbers to newcomers. We found it ineffective. We exchanged phone numbers with newcomers in my home group. And we call them, too. Just a couple, three times. We don't wear them out. This thing about the hand of AA to be here in my pocket, I don't think is quite close enough. I wonder if everybody in this room started doing that. Not giving your phone number, but exchanging. And just call them maybe twice in the next 3 days to say, hi, I'm going to the fellowship group tonight. Maybe see you there. We'll get a cup of coffee. Got a speaker tape you might like, something like that. Because it's not hard for me to call him. It's impossible for him to call me. Wonder what would happen if we started doing that. We started it in my home group. We do a lot of things. Our annual canoe trip and water gun fight is in 3 weekends. No, you're thinking water gun. We're alcoholics. Think water gun. Come on down. You'll love it. It'll be about 40 of us out on the Harpeth River. And we think it's really important for newcomers to see people who've been around for a while having a good time. I am personally committed to having fun in front of newcomers. Am I a great guy or what? I mean, I think it's important to all of us. I want to tell another flying story. I leveled at 40,000 feet one day in that high-performance airplane. Back in the days before the radar told the controller how fast I was going and how high I was, the service ceiling on the plane's 45 grand. You're not supposed to be above 45,000 feet in this thing. Now, they shouldn't have told me that. And especially if they didn't have any way to check. And there are good reasons for it. It's very dangerous to go above there. If you care, I'll tell somebody later. But anyway, I thought, I wonder how high this little beast will go. So I pulled the power back out of afterburner because you can watch the fuel gauges move in afterburner. Left it in what they call military power. And I did what the pilots call an inside climb. That was, I was on my instruments as opposed to looking outside. And I was climbing in the 30-mile circle at 9/10 of the speed of sound. I thought I was going to get to 10 miles at 52,300 and a few. I was down to less than 100 feet a minute rate of climb at 9/10 of the speed of sound. You can climb stairs, most of you, at 100 feet a minute. And that airplane that would do 420 degrees a second roll, I can move the stick like this and nothing happens because there ain't much air above 50. It was 9 o'clock in the morning. I was about 50 miles west of Jacksonville, Florida, over the Georgia-Florida line. And I had just come around to the north to a northerly heading when I looked outside for the first time. Sun's coming up over my right shoulder. Sky above me is black, and out to the west, I looked and saw the curvature of the earth. And I mean, really saw it. And this is in 1966, and not that many people had seen it. Phenomenal experience. And a sense of peace washed over me. I sat there for maybe 30 seconds or a minute looking at that magnificent sight. And a sense of peace washed over me that lasted for a long time. I couldn't tell anybody about it, because if they believed me, I was going to be in trouble. And I never did tell. I never told that story the whole time I was in the Air Force. And this fellow named Burke Harlan from High Point, North Carolina, was one of my mentors. And I spoke at his 12th AA birthday, and I heard myself beginning to tell the story. And I thought, I wonder why I'm telling that. And I got to the end and found out. It's because it was my first spiritual experience. In the poem High Flight, the man says he reached out and touched the face of God. I did. And I see that now as I tell you about it. And I tell you that I want to do that again. That's on my list of things that I want to do again. I want to see the curvature of the earth again. I serve a big God. I'm learning to dream big. I think it's important that I learn to dream big because I do serve a big God. Giving me a big program cures virtually anything. I want to give that God honor. I asked for an open heart when I stood up here, and boy, did I get one today. That's great for me when I can cry and I'm pretty much in touch. If you borrowed my God and worked for you, borrow him some more. Try it again. Try it again. I like to tell one more story. I was in Knoxville a few years ago at a little meeting. 12, 15 people, a little circle. And not like a speaker meeting where you can hide out. They're expecting you to talk when they come to you, too. They want to hear this past thing. And there's an old boy sitting there with his chair rocked back on the back legs and scowl on his face and arms folded. I thought, an attitude case, can't wait. Got to him And he said, I just come back from an ancient ritual, from a medieval ceremony where 10,000 people sat in an unair-conditioned auditorium wearing long robes. I figured it out. That's graduation, University of Tennessee. I got it. Boy's a professor over there. Alex Haley was the featured speaker. He lived just north of there. He spoke a lot around Middle Tennessee. And he said Alex Haley had just said his first opening couple of sentences when this guy forgot all about the air conditioning and the robes and started being grateful for his AA program, because what Alex Haley said for him defined AA better than anything he'd ever heard. Alex Haley wasn't talking about AA. I don't know what he was talking about, but what he said defines us better for me than anything else I ever heard. And what he said was, if you ever see a turtle sitting up on top of a fence post, you'll know he's had help. Thank you for the help.
Thank you.